Time now for our weekly chat with the experts at ETF.com, the world's leading independent authority on ETFs.
Just like with the stock, it's a function of the volume of the security. You can often put your limit order in between those two prices. That's if you're still concerned about how do you value cryptocurrencies.
Sumeet, great having you joining us this week.
Thanks so much for having me, Nate. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Sumeet, I put together a quick montage of clips from last week. These are all from CNBC. Let me play this real quick.
Hong Kong is grappling with its 10th straight week of violent pro-democracy protests, causing the Hong Kong International Airport to shut down today. Then we have Argentina. It's coping with the fallout from current President Mauricio Macri's poor performance in the primary elections. That market was down. It plunged more than 30%. The peso, the Argentinian peso, shed nearly a quarter of its value.
We are getting some news this morning regarding potential U.S.-China trade talks. Let's get to Eamon Javers in Washington.
It was a sea of red on Wall Street with the Dow falling 800 points and closing essentially at the session lows. The stock market's getting punched in the gut from all angles, including the bond market, which is now flashing warning signs of a possible recession.
I'm certainly worried about a recession. I'm worried about a recession in 2020. I think that what makes this particular event different than inversions that we've seen in the past is that Powell has already cut once. Typically, we don't see an inversion until after the point in which the market says, oh, the Fed needs to cut, but they haven't yet. So the Fed has cut 25 basis points. They're going to go another 50 by the end of the year, and still the curve's inverted.
There is a powerful and global downdraft in bond yields this morning. As you guys were saying, the 10-year note down to its lowest yield in roughly 3 years. German Bund, lowest level ever, now even more deeply negative, and increased speculation. U.S. yields could go sub-zero.
All right, so those are all from last week. Hong Kong protests, Argentina stock market cratering, the China trade war, inverted yield curve, negative interest rates around the globe. I'm going to let you choose your own adventure here. So a lot of scary headlines, though. I do think that's usually the case, but maybe there are a few more than what we're used to seeing. What most has your attention right now?
Absolutely, Nate. As those videos suggested, there's a lot of uncertainty in the market right now. But I think without a doubt, if I had to choose one, the most important is the trade war. I mean, it's been the most important story over the past year, and it's probably going to continue being the most important going forward as long as it remains unresolved. Or worse, it keeps intensifying like we saw with the latest round of tariff increases. If you think about it, I mean, the trade war is really at the crux of a lot of these other problems that we're seeing, like the slowdown in China, the slowdown in Europe, and even the recent slowdown here in the U.S. Of course, there's going to be other structural factors that we can talk about that are responsible for slow growth globally. But if it weren't for the trade war, I think we wouldn't be talking about a recession, and we'd be looking at a much rosier picture for the global economy.
So
that said, a lot of the other issues that the video talked about, like the plunge in the Argentine stock market, I mean, that was absolutely mind-boggling. I don't think I've seen anything like that. And I think you mentioned that Bloomberg stat where it's the second biggest single-day drop in any stock market. That's incredible, but I don't think it's going to be something that's going to impact the broader markets. And even if you look at Argentina on an ETF basis, the Argentine ETFs did drop 40%, but their weighting in the emerging market ETFs more broadly is very, very small, 0.2%. So we saw virtually no impact on emerging market ETFs from that. And then, of course, we can talk about the yield curve, Nate. That was the big story last week, but I don't think it's going to be the big story going forward.
Yeah, by the way, with the Argentina ETF, I do think it's important to mention the largest one, the GlobalX MSCI Argentina ETF, ticker ARGT. That traded just fine last week. It didn't blow up for all the ETF fearmongers out there. I think that's important to mention. Sumeet, going back to your comments on the trade war, look, none of us have a crystal ball. It's unclear exactly how this will play out longer term, but what do you see as the most likely path here in terms of resolving this?
I mean, that's the million-dollar question. I think a lot of people have been guessing what's going to happen But it's been so unpredictable. I think we can assume that China and the U.S. want to make a trade deal, but they also both want to save face. We know Trump wants to get reelected, and if this trade war pushes the economy into a recession, that's not going to help them on that front. So I think there's a good chance that as the elections approach, there's going to be a thawing in the trade war. I don't think we're going to see it intensify heading into the elections. That's just not going to be good for Trump's reelection chances. So I don't think he's going to take that risk. But longer term, I think this trade war that we've seen over the past year has completely changed the dynamic between the U.S. and China. And I think we're going to see this type of thing pop up here and there until we get a grand bargain. But I have no idea if we're going to get one and when that's going to happen.
Smeet, it's Connor Kelly. And to add to the fun, obviously, the Hong Kong protest, right? And the flashpoint that, you know, supposedly the Chinese military is starting to deploy and gather on the southern Chinese border. And we talk about trade wars and tariffs and economic wars. And I think there's a chance that perhaps real war is, or at least a conflict with the Chinese military and the protesters in Hong Kong, I think is being perhaps not recognized as real of a possibility as it might seem right now.
Right. And I mean, maybe we should be paying more attention to that, but it's also one of those risks that's so hard to quantify. I mean, how do you account for the Hong Kong protests and what's going on in Hong Kong within U.S. stock prices? How is it going to affect U.S. corporate profits? Really, unless something dramatic happens, it probably won't. But there always is that small likelihood that this situation spirals out of control and causes a black swan type of event.
Smeet, as I think about diversified investors, most diversified investors do own some international stocks. And I actually tweeted out a chart this morning that showed emerging market stocks have produced a zero total return since the beginning of 2011. SPY is up like 176%. And you think about China, Argentina. What's the rationale for investing internationally right now? We know, you know, even beyond emerging market stocks, U.S. stocks have simply dominated here. But then, you know, let's add to that the economic data out of China and Japan and Europe. What's the rationale here?
I think the rationale is valuation. If you look at EM, I think they're trading at something like 10, 11 times earnings. When you look at the U.S., we're trading at around like 17, 18 times earnings. So that's been the case for several years now. Like you said, since 2011, we haven't really had returns in international stocks. But long term, of course, if these earnings in emerging markets continue to grow, the stock prices are going to reflect that. And that's what it comes down to. Long term, stock prices reflect corporate earnings. If we expect, you know, once all this negative news flow finally goes behind us, emerging markets and international stocks might be good for the long term. In the short term, of course, the news flow is so negative. I think U.S. stocks are getting a premium, and rightfully so. But you're going to have to take a very long-term perspective if you get into international stocks. And I think the crux of the bullish thesis is valuation. We're so much lower internationally than in the U.S.
We're visiting with ETF.com, Smeet Roy. Smeet, here in the U.S., the big news last week was the yield curve inversion. So in this case, last Wednesday, 10-year treasuries were briefly yielding less than 2-year treasuries. And I believe something like the past 7 recessions have been preceded by this type of inversion, though we should note not every inversion has ended up with a recession. The question, I guess, is it possible this time is different, that maybe what we're seeing with rates now is just a new normal following all of the central bank stimulus since the financial crisis? Is it possible this time is different?
Yeah, that's a good question, Nate. And, you know, I'm really not that worried about the yield curve because there are a lot of things going on globally that could be distorting the yield curve. I mean, like the ultra-low interest rates and even the negative interest rates that we're seeing overseas. In fact, the Fed put out a study last year that essentially said that in a world in which rates are so low, we can expect that the yield curve is going to invert more often. But that doesn't necessarily mean that recessions are going to happen more often. And then also, like you said, Nate, there have been false positives. I read a note from Ed Yardini the other day, and he said that inverted yield curves have predicted something like 10 of the last 7 recessions. So, yeah, they've been a pretty good, accurate indicator of recessions historically, but they're not foolproof by any means. And then on top of that, you're not really getting any confirmation of a recession from other market indicators like credit spreads in the junk bond market, credit spreads in the investment grade market. And even the S&P 500 is only a few percentage points from its record high. So until we get other indicators confirming recession, I don't think we really need to be panicking right now.
Well, Sumeet, I think some of the most dangerous words in investing are this time it's different. But when you look at the global interest rate landscape, and you hinted at this, I mean, $15 trillion plus in negative yielding bonds worldwide, this is uncharted territory. And I think it's very valid to say that an inversion in the yield curve today might not mean what it has in the past. I think that's very fair to say at this point.
Well, and to me, it's astounding. I mean, you look at 30-year treasuries, they were yielding about 2.6% the last week of July. They're now, you know, down around, what, 2%? And that yield actually fell briefly below that mark for the first time in history last
right.
week, which is just remarkable. And I think somewhat to your point, Sumeet, but I'd be curious to get your thoughts. You know, economic data in the U.S. seems pretty good overall, especially if you look into the labor market. And I've got to tell you, this is completely anecdotal, but we always like to talk to people on the ground. And Connor and I were visiting with a recruiter last week, a headhunter, and he said there aren't enough qualified people to fill all of the job openings out there, that he has companies with really good paying jobs that he can't find enough candidates for. I also spoke with a couple of mortgage lenders last week who both said millennials are finally moving out of their parents' houses or moving out of apartments. They're now looking to buy homes. They both said there's a shortage of housing. I guess point being, those don't sound like things that happen in a deteriorating economy. So, you know, it's like, how do you sort of reconcile the economic data with everything else we're seeing, such as with rates?
Absolutely. There's a huge dichotomy between what we're seeing in specifically the bond market, because we're not seeing it in other markets like the stock market, which hasn't even fallen 10% from its all-time high. There's a dichotomy between the treasury bond market and what we're seeing other markets and also the real economy. And I think that's another reason why we really can't take this inverted yield curve signal and the drop in the 30-year treasury bond to a record low yield as necessarily a signal that a recession is coming. Because, I mean, these yields are moving for other factors. We're seeing zero or negative interest rates overseas. So naturally, treasuries with their 2, even 3% a few weeks ago yields look that much more attractive. And I think we're just pricing into the bond market now the fact that longer term, the new normal is going to be low interest rates. I mean, if you look at the last cycle, the Fed funds rate peaked at 5.25%. This time around, the Fed hiked all the way up to 2.5%, and now it's cutting rates from there. So naturally, if the Fed's funds rate is going to be lower, yields all across the curve are going to be lower. And, you know, people have talked about over the last decade reasons for why interest rates might be lower, things like demographics, the aging of the population, the savings glut, structurally low inflation. These things could be keeping interest rates low, and that does not necessarily mean the economy is going to be doing poorly. I mean, the economy can keep growing 2 to 3% like we've seen since the financial crisis, and interest rates can stay low at the same time.
Sumeet, what about gold? So I was looking over the weekend, something like $5 billion has come into the physical gold ETFs year to date, with over $3 billion of that just in the past month or so. Gold is now over $1,500 an ounce. It's up about 16% on the year. Is this just a classic safe haven play?
It is, Nate. And I mean, gold has really woken up this year. I think got as high as 1520 or a little more than that. And it all comes down to the uncertainty we're seeing in financial markets and also the drop in treasury yields, because gold is a safe haven, or at least it's seen as a safe haven by a lot of people. And it's a safe haven that has a yield of zero, while treasuries are a safe haven that have a positive yield. As treasury yields go down, approach zero, that makes gold naturally that more that much more attractive. And similarly, when we see negative rates in government bonds in Europe and things like that, then gold with its zero yield is even more attractive than something like a German Bund that's yielding negative 0.5%. So I think it's a safe haven play that's been exacerbated by the swift drop in interest rates that we've seen.
By the way, shameless plug, but George Milling Stanley, who is head of gold strategy at State Street Global Advisors, will be joining us on ETF Prime next week. I would say there simply aren't many people walking the face of the earth who know more about gold and gold ETFs than George does. We'll also talk Bitcoin and cryptos, which, by the way, Sumit, I think you and I actually talked about cryptos last time we visited. But here again, like with the fourth quarter of last year, Bitcoin really didn't act like a safe haven during the most recent downturn, even though it was a lot smaller. Now, of course, it's had a great year overall. I just think it needs to react better in market downturns if it wants to be thought of as digital gold or gold 2.0. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, during this latest bout of uncertainty, we have seen Bitcoin do really well. We've actually seen it go, I think, fourfold from the recent low of 3,200 all the way up to as high as 14,000. But, you know, it's way too early, I think, to call Bitcoin a safe haven in the same vein as gold or treasuries. But, I mean, this is one of the first times I recall seeing Bitcoin hold up so well, even when there's so much uncertainty in financial markets. So it's a good start for those claiming that Bitcoin is the next safe haven, that Bitcoin is gold 2.0.
All right, Sumit, just a couple of minutes left. Anything noteworthy with ETF flows, whether recently or year-to-date, anything standing out to you? I know you follow these pretty closely.
So when we look at the aggregate numbers, we're running about $137 billion worth of inflows on a year-to-date basis. That's a little bit below the $156 billion we saw at the same time last year. And most of the inflows are going into fixed income, $76 billion, and then the next highest segment are U.S. equity ETFs, which have $48 billion. But I don't think the interesting figures are on the headlines. You got to dig a little bit deeper. And I think what really stands out to me are the fastest growing ETFs. I did a story on this a couple of weeks ago. And we saw a huge pickup in assets in two ESG ETFs, the Vanguard ESG International Stock ETF, VSGX, and the Vanguard ESG U.S. Stock ETF, ESGV. They saw a fivefold increase in their assets under management this year. And both of them now have, I think, over $500 million worth of assets. So Vanguard getting into the ESG game now has, you know, hundreds of million dollars in assets. I think that is a very good sign for ESG's future and might be evidence that ESG is finally entering the mainstream.
Well, Sumit, we're going to have to leave it there. Appreciate the insight. Great stuff as always. Thank you for joining us this week.
Thanks for having me, Nate.
That was ETF.com, Sumit Roy.